rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Friday, the first hour of our program, and as always, for years now, for 3 years plus, I believe, now, the first hour of our Friday program, we hand over to Senator Bernie Sanders. It was Congressman Bernie Sanders for a number of years for our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, and I think of Bernie as America's congressman. He's not a Democrat, he's not a Republican, he's a straight shooter, and he will be taking your calls and you know, responding straight up. Senator Sanders, Bernie, welcome to the program.
How are you, Tom?
I'm great. I'm so still having.
We've been doing it for years. It makes us sound like we're about 130 years of age.
Yeah.
Before 80, I really got off the ground. You and I were sitting on the porch talking, and we put it on the radio now. Huh?
Sometimes it seems that way. And I'm still having a hard time saying. Yeah, I keep wanting to say Congressman Sanders, and it's just I'm anyhow. What's your sense of the difference between the House and the Senate? And then, you know, whatever you want to talk
about. Well, there are a lot of differences, and there's a lot of stuff that's going on that I want to get into in a few minutes.
Sure.
The Senate is a very, very different institution than the House. The rules are far different, and they enable every single member to play a significant role on every single piece of legislation. The truth of the matter is, and I don't particularly think this is a good idea, but it's a reality that almost any senator could bring the entire United States government to a halt. That's the reality.
So senators have a lot more power than members.
Oh, absolutely. And the issue here, though, is the structure of the Senate is that it is relatively easy to stop things you don't want. But the converse of that, it is relatively difficult to make things happen that you do want. And that has to do with the fact that in the House, you need 50% of the votes plus one to pass legislation. But in the Senate, if you have 60 votes, you can stop anything you want. Right now, for example, we yesterday passed, finally, the minimum wage increase from the outrageously low $5.15 an hour to $7.25 an hour. The House did the right thing and passed a clean bill. That's all they did. The Senate insisted, the Republicans in the Senate, delayed and delayed and delayed and threatened not to pass any minimum wage increase unless they could get tax breaks for business. And what we ended up passing was a bill providing $8 billion plus in tax breaks over a 10-year time with the minimum wage. By the way, this is an improvement over what the Republicans did last time when they wanted $700 billion in tax breaks to the very wealthiest people in this country. So, but the point here is, it looks very hard. It looks like it will be very hard to pass a clean $7.25 an hour increase in the Senate because the Republicans certainly have, with 49 votes, can bring the whole thing to a halt unless you give them something that they want. So that is just one example of every piece of legislation that goes through. You need 60 votes to get cloture, and certainly we don't have that. And the Republicans can slow up anything, defeat anything, and that's how they negotiate.
Yeah, interesting. So what are the topics in the top of your mind here today?
Well, we have introduced, here are some of the issues that are out there. Obviously, raising the minimum wage, which will happen, is a step forward. We need to go a lot further than that. As you and I have talked about a whole lot, we need to take a hard look at trade. Trade deficit with China is going up. Our national trade deficit is going up. And bottom line there is we need policies which get corporate America to start reinvesting in the United States of America, creating good-paying jobs in this country. We've got to stop the exodus of white-collar information technology jobs to India and other countries, because if we don't deal with that issue, our kids will probably have a lower standard of living than we do. So that's an issue.
Now, how do you think we should best do that?
Well, we are going to be working with others, among other things, to repeal permanent normal trade relations with China. And that's not because I am anti-Chinese. That's not because I do not want our country to have a positive relationship to China or trade with China. The current trade policy is an absolute disaster because corporations have made it very clear that they would much prefer to hire people being paid 30 cents an hour who go to jail when they form a union rather than hire American workers. What you're going to see there, Tom, is some interesting coalitions of progressives such as myself working with some conservatives. And I think we're going to have the support of the American people who, if this campaign showed us anything, the November election showed us anything, is that those of us who expressed deep concerns about current trade policy did very, very well. Those people who told their constituents that unfettered free trade was a great idea, they did not do so well. So I think we have the American people behind us who want to move on that issue. There's another issue out there, Tom, that you and many of your listeners should be especially proud of. And I'm sure you noticed that in Florida, Governor Charlie Crist announced plans to abandon the touchscreen voting machines.
Right. He's going to a paper ballot.
He's going to a paper ballot. Now, that's an issue I know you have been talking about for many years. I know that there's almost not, you know, every week that I'm on the show, people will call up and express real concerns.
Yeah.
And let's be very clear. The reason these things change is, in fact, there has been strong grassroots activism on this issue for a number of years.
And that's always the bottom line.
That is, and then it perked on up to Secretary of State last year. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
They expressed concerns about the possible manipulation. Then you had in another fiasco in Florida. And then finally, you have people from both parties coming together and say, hey, we don't need this anymore. Let's count the ballot straight. Let's end any of the ambiguities that may be out there. Let's give confidence to the people. Well, this is an issue that we're winning. If it happens in a large state like Florida, it will spread, I believe, all over the country. Some of us in the Senate will try to accelerate that spreading. People should know when they cast a ballot that their votes are accurately counted. If you don't have confidence in that, we are in deep, deep trouble. Global warming, huge issue. You know, we have an administration which is so pathetic that when the president mentioned global climate change, this is thought to be one of the most insightful and profound statements that he ever made, when, of course, virtually every scientist in the world who has been studying this issue for years understands that global warming is a man-made phenomenon, that the repercussions of global warming will impact billions of people if we do not get a handle on it. I am on both the Energy Committee, which is chaired by Barbara Boxer of California. That's the Environmental Committee, I'm sorry, and the Energy Committee, chaired by Jeff Bingaman of New Mexico. Both of those committees now are going to be focusing very strongly on global warming, which is a radical change from what existed a few months ago, when you had people who were chairing committees who really didn't even believe that global warming was a man-made phenomenon or that, in fact, it was a reality. So you can expect to see now in the Senate, and I'm sure in the House as well, strong legislation which begins to move forward in a very bold way to limit greenhouse gas emissions, to move this country from fossil fuels, coal, oil, etc., to sustainable energy, and equally important, move us forward very radically into energy efficiency in terms of raising CAFE standards on cars, ending the absurdity of the United States now having cars which get worse mileage per gallon than we did 20 years ago. I mean, that's pretty crazy. And I think you're going to see some significant changes in requirements about funding solar, wind, biomass, geothermal. So I think you're going to see some very good changes in that area. Yes,
and going back maybe to Jimmy Carter's idea of offering tax incentives as well as funding things?
Absolutely. You're going to see a lot of that. We're going to be encouraging people to buy cars that get good mileage and good mileage per gallon. We're going to be putting pressure on Detroit, which has really been quite pathetic. Detroit has received substantial amounts of corporate welfare in the past to try to make energy-efficient cars. They really have failed terribly.
Yeah.
They come up with excuses every single day, and they're telling us, well, they got this car coming out in 10 years and that car coming out in 15 years. Meanwhile, the Japanese are doing a much better job. And we can do that. We can produce cars that get good mileage. And I happen to believe that there is a place in our transportation system for electric cars, plug-in cars.
Sure.
You know, there are millions of people who work 20 or 30 miles away from their home. They drive 30 miles, they drive back. You can plug that car in the nighttime, and it solves your needs.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work you're going to be seeing on that. Obviously, the Iraq issue is huge. It will be coming up next week. There'll be a lot of debate, a lot of playing around with rules and cloture and so forth and so on. The good news here is that you're having some pretty conservative Republicans, like John Warner of Virginia, who is the former chairman of the Armed Forces Committee, who has now come out against Bush's escalation of the war, and I think that's significant.
Yeah, that is. It's huge. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie will be taking your calls right after this break, and for the rest of the hour, 866-440-THOM. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartmann.com. 16 minutes past the hour. Welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. It's the Tom Hartmann Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment, our first hour of every Friday. Every week, Senator Bernie Sanders with us taking your calls. Our number, 866-440-8466. And Bernie, ready to go at it?
Ready.
Okay. James in New Paltz, New York. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, Tom and Bernie, thank you for taking my call. My question is about NAFTA. And I'm thinking both philosophically and practically. Senator Sanders, is there any possibility we could just actually have an actual discussion about NAFTA and its impact on this country and what it's done to the countries around us? And just go right to the take this head on and actually debate the practicality of the free market. Is the free market this miracle cure that everyone keeps talking about?
Yeah, let me just toss into that, James and Bernie, if you don't mind. Here in Portland, Freightliner is one of the last companies in the United States that makes trucks, commercial trucks. They are laying off 800 people, and they're building a factory in Mexico.
Well, that's exactly the issue. And James, thanks for that question. You know, I think that a lot of people don't think of NAFTA and the whole question of trade as a very sexy issue. But it is enormously important, and I think we've got to understand it if we're going to deal with the reality of why the middle class in America today is shrinking and poverty is increasing, and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider, despite a huge increase in worker productivity and a spurt in technology. To my mind, as somebody who voted against NAFTA and had legislation in the House to repeal permanent normal trade relations with China, I think James raises a very important issue. And James, what you are going to see in the next year is a much more serious discussion about trade than you have seen in the past. Under Republican leadership, with some Democratic support, the mantra was that free trade was just wonderful, it was great, but I think as a result of this last election, there are a number of us in the Senate who really don't believe that, who want to examine our trade policies and, frankly, want to reform them in a very, very fundamental way. To my mind, if you look at NAFTA, for example, and the history of NAFTA, what has happened in Mexico is that young farmers in the rural areas of Mexico have basically been driven off of the land. Poverty has increased in Mexico. In the United States, we have lost a whole lot of good-paying jobs. I think the beneficiaries of NAFTA have been the CEOs of large corporations and not the working people of any of the three countries. I think similarly that's true in terms of what PNTR has done to American workers. So you are going to see a lot more discussion on that than you have in the past, and some of us are going to work hard to make fundamental reforms in our trade policy.
Bravo. Robin in, is it pronounced Joaquin, Washington?
It's Hoquiam.
Hoquiam. Oh, it's actually pronounced the way it looks. Okay.
Yeah, right up there by Aberdeen.
Uh-huh.
Howdy, Tom. This is Robin. Blues man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. In the chat room. Yeah.
The Freightliner deal, actually, they built a factory in Mexico back in the 90s. With the initiation of NAFTA.
Yeah.
So
well,
I guess maybe they're building another one.
They're either building another one or they're expanding it because they're taking 800 jobs out of this town.
Yeah. Yeah. They took quite a few back then, too. At any rate, what I'm calling about is I was chatting online with my son-in-law the other day and found out that he's over in Iraq, and I found out that he's paying $5.70 a meal to eat. And they're charging him that. Are you there?
They're charging him for meals?
Yes. And While I can't exactly say that he is in Iraq because he told me he can't tell me where he is, I know that he went to Iraq. His job is to check out packages that soldiers are taking home with them to make sure that there's no contraband or anything that they're trying to smuggle out of the country.
So
now,
is this because Halliburton privatized the meals?
Halliburton, and when he told me that, I told him to, you know, just look the guy straight in the eye and say very calmly, if I have to pay for this food, then you will go on patrol with me tomorrow. But, you know, naturally, I don't know if that's going to get him anywhere. They're already being paid $25 to $30 a plate to feed our troops. Now they're charging our troops. His wife and daughter are doing okay, but when he comes home from Iraq, he's not going to have any income, and they could use that extra $500 a month.
Hmm. Well, you know, Robin, you raise a question that many of us have been asking and talking about for a while. And that is that at a time, not only with regard to food, but more basic equipment like armor and so forth, it's pretty indisputable that our troops who have gone over there over the years have not had the equipment that they need. The idea that anybody is paying for food who is representing our country is absurd. And meanwhile, Halliburton has been making record-breaking profits in recent years. What you are going to see, again, with the change in Congress is instead of members of Congress being a rubber stamp, those are precisely the kinds of questions that will be investigated by a number of committees, and we're going to fight to change that.
Yeah, this is a great example of the failure of privatization.
Right.
Yeah. 27 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. We'll continue right after this break. The Tom Hartman radio program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. And welcome back for your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity, the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. John in Abilene, Texas. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hey.
Senator.
How are you, John?
Congress authorized President Bush to use force in Iraq in fall of 2002. Can Congress revoke that authorization?
Yes. That's a very good question. That's something that Senator Kennedy and I and some others are precisely looking at. Needless to say, as a member of the House, I voted against giving the president the authority. But what people are arguing now is that the argument that the president made in 2002 and what the members of Congress voted for was to rid or deal with what Bush was saying were the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, which, of course, was not true, and the imminent threat of an attack of Iraq against the United States, which obviously is no longer relevant, was not true then either. So the question is, why are we in Iraq right now? And it's a very, very different purpose. There's now a civil war going on. And what people have been saying, and I agree with this, that if the president wants to increase the number of our troops, escalate the war, he should come back for a new authorization. And that makes sense to me. So to answer your question, John, that is something the Congress can do. Do we have the votes to do it? No. But some of us are working on precisely that issue.
Hey, Bernie, I just have to tell you something in between calls here. You know, you visited us at the Radio Row last week in Washington, D.C.
Yep.
We just confirmed yesterday the Conservative Union is the American Conservative Union is doing a Radio Row, and they're going to have Dick Cheney and Ann Coulter and all these, you know, administration officials who are going to be there to talk to the talk show hosts. And I'll be the only liberal talk show host there, but I'll be there in Washington, D.C. Should be a hoot. So I'll fill you in on
that. John's point is a good point. We have to understand that the reasons that the president is now giving for our troops being in Iraq is radically different than what he gave us when we went to war in the first place. Yeah. And we should rethink and rediscuss that issue.
Absolutely. Larry in Oklahoma, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Mr. Sanders, I have a question for you. Do we have any oversight over the Blackwater contractors?
Sure we do. I mean, the Congress, Larry, has the authority to have oversight over every aspect of the functioning of the United States government. That certainly includes our contractors in Iraq.
Okay. Well, I've seen where Britain has been fired on, and we have no records of our air flight schedule showing that we had any airplanes in that area.
Hmm.
The British troops was fired on, and so I was just wondering, you know, are we sure? I mean, it's just a question that was brought up, and we was wondering about it.
Okay. Well, the answer to your question is that's certainly something that the Congress could look at.
Yeah. 1-866-440-8466. Gary in Idaho, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Mr. Sanders and Tom.
Hey, Gary.
My question comes from a basic concern that Bush plans attacks against Iran in the near future. Based on the increasing rhetoric that's coming out of Washington, pointing to Iran as being more and more involved in the Iraq war and killing American soldiers, I just read an article by Scott Ritter that he wrote in The Nation, in which he voices similar concerns. He calls for a joint resolution in Congress specifically requiring Bush to come to Congress for formal approval prior to any attacks against Iran. My question is, where would the process for this joint resolution begin? And it's kind of similar to John in Abilene, his question.
Mm-hmm.
Where would that process begin, and which member of Congress would be the most influential in contacting about something?
Well, if my memory is correct, Joe Biden, who is chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, has been very clear about that and saying that if the president went to war and attacked Iran without authority of the United States Congress, this would provoke a very deep constitutional crisis. And I must tell you, I met with Condoleezza Rice just a couple of days ago and made exactly that point as well. So you are seeing more and more members of the House and the Senate, including leading members, so this is the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, making it very clear that if the president has any idea of attacking Iran, and I certainly hope he doesn't, I certainly would not support that, that absolutely and positively he has got to come before the Congress for authority. I don't think he would get that authority, and if he did it independently of that authority, he would be provoking, in my view, a major constitutional crisis.
Larry in Grand Rapids, Michigan. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Larry.
I have a question. You alluded to the idea of getting the U.S. automakers to raise their CAFE standards, both to help them and to lessen our energy dependence on other countries. The way it's being reported here in Michigan, John Dingell in the House and Kyle Levin in the Senate have both said don't even ever try to raise that issue. Is that the feeling you've gotten with any discussions with them, that talk of prodding the car companies through legislation is just an off-the-table issue?
Well, I think the representatives from Michigan think that they're doing the right thing. They think that they're protecting jobs in Michigan by working with the automobile industry there, who have been very insistent over the years against raising CAFE standards. I think, given the fact that Ford, among others, has just reported a $12 billion loss this year, that the automobile industry in the United States is doing very terribly, I think these guys have been wrong. I think they have been terribly wrong. I think the result of that has been massive layoffs for workers, loss of profits, lower dividends for stockholders. So I think what you are seeing is in the Congress more and more sentiment for increasing the CAFE standards. As you know, within the House, Nancy Pelosi is maneuvering to try to get this issue, in fact, away from the Commerce Committee, putting together another committee to deal with global warming. There's some reason to believe that that maybe is an effort to take that issue away from Mr. Dingell. But I think overall what you are going to see is, in fact, an increase in CAFE standards and major efforts in many areas to make our country much more energy efficient and move us to sustainable energy.
Leo in Seattle, Washington. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, my question is about a couple of bills that passed at the end of last year. There was a bankruptcy reform bill and a pension reform bill, and they both actually reformed bankruptcy and pensions the wrong way, in my opinion. I was wondering, what is the process of repealing a bill once it's already gone through Congress? I know Senator Sanders is in the Senate now, but I figure he can answer the question.
Well, as that happens, I voted against both of those bills, Leo, because I think you're right. The answer is very simply that the United States Congress, and everybody should understand this, has the right to do anything it wants, bring up any legislation at any time it wants. So the fact that a major bankruptcy bill was passed a couple of years ago that happened to be a bad bill, could that be revisited tomorrow? Absolutely it could. Of course, the same with pensions. What is the likelihood of that happening? Probably not great, because there are many in Congress who say, hey, we quote-unquote dealt with that issue. Why do we want to bring it up again? But we certainly could. And in both of those areas, I will be active, because I think both of those pieces of legislation ended up representing the needs of corporate America, credit card companies, banks, large corporations, rather than the needs of the middle class and working families.
Maurice in Bennington, Vermont. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon or morning, depending on where you are. Maurice Raincourt in Bennington. Bernie, congratulations.
Hey, Maurice, how are you?
Yeah, fine. Always good to have you down in our neighborhood. And good to have you on Tom Hartman's show. Tom, thanks for all the work that you do.
You're welcome.
Listen, I'm going to take a play from Hans Christian Andersen's The Emperor's New Set of Clothes and pop a question that's been burning with me, which is, the background is, everybody's speaking about a global war on terror, even those who are in opposition to the Bush administration policies. My question, which is somewhat outside the box, is, what global war on terror? When was it declared? When was it sanctioned by Congress? I'm really at a loss, and I'd really love to
let me try to answer your question, if I can. Obviously, the president has made the quote-unquote global war on terror the main focus of his 6 years in the presidency, and many of us think that terrorism is, in fact, a very serious issue. What happened on 9/11 is of enormous consequence to this country. The fear that it could happen again tomorrow is something that we have got to be very mindful of, not to mention what's happened in Madrid, London, many other countries around the world where a lot of innocent people were killed. So I think that there are people out there, Al-Qaeda and other people, who, given the opportunity, would do us terrible harm. The question is, how do we most effectively prevent attacks against the United States, and how do we most effectively defeat these people? And I think that the war in Iraq, and of course I'm not alone in saying this, has made a difficult situation a lot worse. We have squandered huge amounts of manpower and resources in Iraq rather than, in fact, going after Al-Qaeda. And from a political and economic point of view, we are not doing enough to undermine the reasons that Al-Qaeda is giving for their anti-Americanism. So this has to be fought on multi-levels. I frankly don't think we're doing a great job at it.
Well said. 45 minutes past the hour. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. We'll be back with your calls in just a moment. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice.
I hope the days come easy and the moments pass slow, and each road leads you where you want to go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window.
And welcome back. Truth and Common Sense in Broadcasting for a Change in America. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Bob in Dearborn, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Senator Sanders.
Hi, Bob.
I was just curious, what can Senator Leahy and the Judiciary Committee do about Alberto Gonzalez and the Justice Department firing all those attorneys?
As a matter of fact, that's, I believe, I'm not 100% sure. I know that Dianne Feinstein raised that issue on the floor of the Senate, and I believe that is an issue that Senator Leahy is going to look at. My understanding, I'm not an expert on this, but my understanding is that Bush used or Gonzalez used a provision of the Patriot Act, certainly not meant for this procedure, to fire a number of U.S. attorneys and replace them
with right-wing political supporters. And clearly that is absolutely wrong. And I think you're going to see Senator Leahy's committee look at that.
Good. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hey, guys. Great show. Senator, I have a message directly for you. I'm a postal worker, and I'm a letter carrier here in Tacoma. And the president, as you know, just signed that signing statement saying he can open our mail under circumstances he decides. But also, when I went to the union to encourage them to get active about it, you know, they were okay with passing a resolution, but they don't want to get too political because at the same time, the president's board of governors are trying to slip privatization into our new contract. And so it's a two-pronged assault on postal workers, and I'd really love to get some help from a senator.
Okay, Jeff. Well, I mean, I'm sympathetic to you on both of those issues. And I think you will see more comment and investigation and a very clear statement on the part of the relevant committee that we do not want the government going through the mail of innocent Americans. That's totally absurd, and that's just one more example of this president not understanding basic constitutional rights and very aggressively undermining our civil liberties. And in terms of privatization, you have an administration from day one, that has waged an assault upon federal workers, whether they're postal workers, customs workers, whatever they may be, in trying to privatize significant numbers of jobs so that Americans will end up doing essentially the same work at lower pay. The American people suffer because turnover rate will be much higher. We're not going to have the kind of security that we need from well-trained workers in many sensitive areas. So we are working with the National Association of Letter Carriers on those issues, Jeff, and I hope and suspect that we'll be successful.
Good. Richard in Clareton, Pennsylvania. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Did you see me?
I did. Richard, you're on the air.
Senator Sanders, how are you?
I'm great, Richard.
Good. Congratulations. And I've listened to you quite regularly. My brother has lived in Vermont and loved you. Your altruistic points are very well taken, and I hope they work out. And you started out your conversation today with the one point I would like to make known is that now you can filibuster, and I hope you save our boys. I don't care how much money spent, but I hope you can save our boys. If anything else goes on that can kill any more of our strong, brave troops, I want you to get there and filibuster like that guy in history that did it until he passed out. I sure hope you can do it.
Well,
thank you for your hard work.
It's going to be in my office, along with a number of others, Senator Feingold, Senator Kennedy, and others, are going to be very strong in doing everything that we can to bring our troops home from this disastrous war as soon as we possibly can. I think what you're going to see unfolding in the Senate in the next month will be a fairly weak, not as strong as I would like, bipartisan resolution led by Senator Warner, which expresses disapproval and disagreement with the president's escalation of the war. And the importance of that is that we're bringing prominent Republicans into that arena. Then you're going to see efforts to use the budget process to stop the escalation. And then you're going to see efforts to use the budget process to bring our troops home as soon as possible in an orderly manner. To make these things happen, obviously, we're going to need grassroots activism all over this country to stand up and say enough is enough. We don't want our troops to remain in harm's way and to be in the middle of a civil war, which is not why they were sent there in the first place.
Amen. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hey, hi, Bernie.
Hi.
I'm going to start with a quote here from Herbert Hoover and tell you how it's connected here. He said in 1929, "We in America today are nearer to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of any land. And within months, the stock market crashed and the Republican Great Depression started. Last night, AP reported the 2006 personal savings rate dropped to the lowest level since the Republican Great Depression, and Bush touts our fabulous economy. Is that a scary
here's the point. President Bush, the vice president, and many people of his administration keep telling how great this economy is doing. And yet in the last 6 years, over 5 million more Americans have slipped into poverty. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. Year after year, median family income goes down. There are millions of workers today who are working longer hours for lower wages than they used to. The statistics are pretty clear that it takes two people in a family now working have less disposable income than a one-income family did 30 years ago. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. So, Tom, I agree with you. This indebtedness, personal indebtedness, is very frightening. The middle class is in deep trouble, regardless of what President Bush and his friends tell us.
Thank you, Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom. Thank
always,
you.
Always great having you.
Bye-bye.
Senator Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, by the way, his website. In the next hour, we're going to be discussing, I'll be debating with John Berlow. He's the policy director for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He says, Consumer Reports, not good for you. Yeah. And that plus the news of the day, a lot going on in the world we'll be talking about. Plus, we'll be taking your calls. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. For a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
Well, there's an enormous amount of stuff going on in the world today. George W. Bush, he wants $245 billion more for war. This guy just loves war. We'll get into some of the details of that in a little bit. And smelly orange snow showering Siberia. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Committee Panel on Climate Change, has issued a final report saying 90% probability, 90% certainty. That's, you know, in scientific speak, that's very, very, very high. That man-made activity, carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases is distorting the atmosphere, and that the consequences are going to be really nasty. And we'll be getting into that as well. Plus, more on the Scooter Libby trial, a few interesting little tidbits coming out of that. Right now, however, John Berlow is with us. He's the policy director for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. John, welcome.
Tom, thanks. I'm a policy director for CEI. I've got a few other good people there who are policy directors.
Oh, okay. Multiple titles, or multiple folks with the same title. Okay, cool. John, you wrote an article here. You're the author of a book called Eco Freaks: Environmentalism is Hazardous to Your Health. And
yeah.
Now you've got an article coming out saying that Science Digest, Consumer Reports, excuse me, a Consumer Reports, a nonprofit organization, nonprofit magazine, no advertising support, no corporate influence, is bad for your health? Or bad for our health?
They have made a lot of good recommendations in the past. I've read them, but unfortunately, as demonstrated with the latest, their own recall of the car seat safety, that sometimes they have agendas and they will exaggerate things, or sometimes they will look at things like pesticides or food from biotech in a sort of skewed way.
They have agendas?
Yes.
What? What's their agenda?
Well, and there's nothing wrong with having an agenda, but consumers, they're a part of Consumers Union, which lobbies for a lot of on the liberal sides of the issues, such as more fuel economy standards, and that's fine. But in the past, Consumer Reports would say things like smaller cars or cars with less weight do give you less protection in crashes, whereas recently in 2002 they said they dismissed that as an industry complaint, even though the National Academy of Sciences had acknowledged that the standards did lead to some additional crashes.
So the agenda that the Consumers Union has is what you call a liberal agenda. What I'd say is that an agenda skewed toward the needs of the consumers and of humans, and you're concerned because your agenda, which is presumably to defend the big multinational corporations, might not be in agreement with their agenda. Would you argue that?
Well, to a degree. Well, my argument is there's nothing, and I'm a little disappointed with the way some of the big multinational corporations want to just rush in and say how green they are, ignoring the consequences of some of the rhetoric. But also, I guess my thing is, and my is kind of, you know, a warning to consumers that, you know, you look at every product with skepticism.
So if we're not supposed to trust the Consumers Union and Consumer Reports for information about products, and frankly, I would say good on them for admitting that they made a mistake earlier. I mean, I rather than criticizing them, but if I follow your logic, we're not supposed to trust them. Who are we supposed to trust? The big corporations? The PR flacks for the big corporations?
We're really not supposed to trust completely anyone, I don't think, Tom. I mean, you just use a grain of skepticism whenever product you buy, whatever you read.
So when I buy a car, I'm supposed to take apart the computer in it and make sure that it operates properly. I'm supposed to go out and drive it into a wall at 60 miles an hour and make sure that it'll survive a crash. I'm supposed to roll it over and see if it crushes me and then decide to buy it?
No, but you can look at multiple things like Consumer Reports, like Edmunds.com, like other services. Read the auto pages of newspapers, and yes, just take everything what you do take everything with a grain of salt and examine claims, and that's just a general generally good advice for a good news consumer. The kind of things I write about at EcoFreaks.
Yeah, isn't it that the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org, John? We're talking with John Berlow, a policy director for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Isn't it really that you guys just want to promote the interests of the corporations and to hell with the consumers? I mean you have every right to do that, but I mean, isn't that really the bottom line here?
We think consumers benefit from having choices as far as whether to buy SUVs or other products. We think, you know, genetically modified food will offer more competition and will improve public health. So
more competition for what? We're seeing species vanish as a consequence of the homogenization, the reduction in the number of varieties of species of our food plants, if nothing else out there.
One of the things it could result in, and Norman Borlaug, the Nobel laureate who helped India become self-sustaining in agriculture, said this. I mean, is reduction of pesticides, and then we could still have the benefits of pesticides from high yield farming, not using too much land, and have land for, you know, for forest and wildlife.
But that might only be short term. I'm assuming you're talking about BT corn that has Bacillus thermophilus, the gene for it bred into it, so it's producing its own internal pesticide. The problem with that is that gene jumps into the wild, and it already has, and then wild plants start producing it, and then what happens is the pests who are whacked, you know, who are wiped out by the toxin of Bacillus thermophilus become immune to it, and now you got superbugs coming back, and, you know, we're back where we started. It's the same thing with, you know, using massive antibiotics with animals and people.
But you don't stop. The thing is, you don't stop using antibiotics because there are some problems, because there's some resistance.
Yes, you do. You stop routinely giving them to animals because you're creating resistant bugs. I mean, we've got a huge problem with hospitals all around the world right now with these methicillin, I think it's called, resistant staph infections, MSRI, and, you know, killing people because of the overuse of antibiotics. You've got the entire medical industry saying, hey, wait a minute, let's cut back on the use of antibiotics.
A cutback is one thing, but you don't cease using it if it's the best thing out there, and you try to find better antibiotics, better growing techniques, and that's what we're worried about. Regulatory barriers to some of those things helping, you know, and with sometimes regulations, oftentimes they benefit established businesses at the expense of new entrants, new entrepreneurs.
All right. I'm sorry. I just got distracted there. We're talking with John Berlow. He's the author of EcoFreaks, Environmentalism is Hazardous to Your Health. How is environmentalism hazardous to your health, John?
I think because there are a lot of examples in the book, the malaria surge after DDT ban here and restrictions. But generally, I'm arguing for something that, you know, where you look at, you know, both people, wildlife, and things, you know, on the planet rather than, say, the ecosystem and the environment as a whole. Because sometimes I think if you're looking at the ecosystem, when you want to preserve land as it always was and you don't know that was the way land was as always was, you sometimes do things that are detrimental both to people and wildlife.
But don't you get it that we're all part of the same system, that it's not just all here for the people? Or is that your worldview, that everything should be determined, the value of everything should be determined in the context of its value to us humans?
Well, I would go with the old Democratic Party slogan, put people first. But I do think you should look at what affects
wildlife. But ultimately that hurts us, because if we say, oh, we're only going to do it if it values humans, and then we discover that, you know, the complexity, which includes a lot of things that we can't see any immediate use for, any immediate value for. Complexity is necessary for the survival of the environment, of the ecosystem, and we strip that complexity out. I mean, we're looking at half of all species vanishing here in the next 30, 40 years. And that, I mean, you can operate with one kidney. You can't operate with half your organs gone. What about the idea of simply saying complexity for its own sake is fine? That's the way nature is.
Well, I don't know that the way nature is and has been. There are diseases, hurricanes. I mean, it's only now that we're looking at nature as kind and sweet when we found a way to manage it. Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1935, Mr. Democrat, bragged about how when building the Hoover Dam, which wasn't called it back then, we are altering the geography of a whole region.
Right, and now we're taking these dams apart because we're discovering that they're wiping out ecosystems and destroying species like salmon.
But dams are, and not all dams are good, are renewable energy, power from water. And to say that we shouldn't, what are we going to use? Coal?
How about the wind? How about solar?
We could use all those things, but let's look at what's viable and look at what's cost effective.
Yeah, interesting. John Berlow, he is a policy director for the Competitive Enterprise Institute, CEI.org. Thanks, John, for being on the program. Good talking with you. Our number 866-440-8466. We'll be right back. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Listener-supported radio, supported by you, our listeners. Listening for sponsors, particularly our local sponsors, whatever you're hearing on your local radio station, and letting them know that you're listening. And our national sponsors as well, like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, all organic, all fair trade, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, latest iPods and all things Macintosh, the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com, 1-888-ECO-WINE, and Purina One Natural Blends at 866-380-MEOW, M-E-O-W. 21 minutes past the hour. Our quote for the day from Lyndon Johnson: my most fervent prayer is to be a president who can make it possible for every boy in this land to grow to manhood by loving his country instead of dying for it. Tragically, LBJ didn't quite work out that way. George W. Bush is moving $1.3 billion out of levy funding. Yes, out of levy funding. This from the New Orleans newspaper. It's over at NOLA.com. President Bush is expected to shift $1.3 billion away from raising and armoring levees, installing floodgates, and building permanent pumping in southeast Louisiana in order to plug long-anticipated financial shortfalls in other hurricane protection projects, a move Senator David Vitter, Republican from Louisiana, describes as a retreat from the president's commitment to protect the whole New Orleans area. That was amazing. This really, I mean, the bottom line is why. So he can have tax cuts for millionaires and billionaires. I mean, you'll recall, he said, you know, if we give $550,000 per job, then we'll create some jobs in tax cuts, right? It's seemed to work out, hasn't it?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. And we now have the highest child poverty rate of any industrialized nation in the world. Over 5 million additional people have slipped into poverty in the United States since Bush, just since he became president. In the meantime, the IPCC has come out. The world, this is from the New York Times today, the world is already committed to centuries of warming, shifting weather patterns, and rising seas from the atmospheric buildup of smokestack and tailpipe gases that trap heat. But warming can be substantially blunted with prompt action, an international network of climate experts said today. In a report released here today, the group, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change of the UN, in its fourth assessment since 1990, the causes and consequences of climate change, for the first time expressed with near certainty, more than 90% confidence, that carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping greenhouse gases were the main drivers of warming since 1950. This is really pretty startling stuff. And you just look at the numbers. And it's really very straightforward. Back in 1900, you had carbon dioxide in the atmosphere at around 300 parts per million. Now it's pushing 400 parts per million. That's a 25% increase. In methane, which is, by the way, I think 15 to 19 times more effective at trapping greenhouse, trapping heat than carbon dioxide. In 1800, we were at about 500 parts per billion. Now we're pushing 2,000 parts per billion. Nitrous oxide, another greenhouse gas, we were at 270 parts per billion as recently as 1850, 1900. It started going up as we were burning coal and then oil. Now we're pushing 330, 320 parts per billion from 270 to 320. Sea level change. From 1900 to today, it's gone up about 8 inches all around the world. Snow cover in the northern hemisphere. The average, we first started keeping records in the 1920s in the northern hemisphere, in millions of square miles. Total was around 15 million square miles that was covered with snow. Now we're down to around 13 million square miles covered with snow. And of course, that reduces the reflection. So the IPCC is saying, we've got something to worry about. At the same time, the new National Intelligence Estimate comes out and says basically that Iran is not the problem. Here's a quote from the NIE. Iraq's neighbors influence or are influenced by events within Iraq, but the involvement of these outside actors is not likely to be a major driver of influence or the prospects for stability because of the self-sustaining character of Iraq's internal sectarian divides. I mean, there you go. The next sentence, nonetheless, Iranian lethal support for select groups of Iraqi Shia militants clearly intensifies the conflict in Iraq. But the bottom line is, number one, you've got a bunch of Iraqis who are saying, no, thank you very much. We don't want our country to be occupied. And number two, you've got Shias who want to kill Sunnis, you got Sunnis who want to kill Shias, you got Kurds who just assume everybody left them alone, and within the Shia and within the Sunni communities, you have tribal conflicts that in some cases are going back thousands of years, or certainly generations, hundreds of years and generations, and these are now, the glue that held it all together. Unfortunately, it was a dictator. Ideally something better would come along. And typically, when democracies emerge, they do. They grow from the inside out. And, very often there's something like a revolution, but it's from the inside out. You can't bomb a country into democracy. It doesn't work, and that's what we're seeing. And so here we have this absolute disaster in Iraq. So, a lot going on here. Also, thinking about exercise can have the same effects as exercise. I'm going to share that with you, and we'll be taking your calls right after the break. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you. I'm falling, I'm falling. Show me what it's like. So that won't stand and teach me wrong from right. And I'll show you what I can be. Faithfully stand to me. And I'll leave this life behind me. And welcome back, Defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, noon to 3 Eastern time, 9 to noon Pacific time. Welcome back. Welcome back. And time now.
Now, behind enemy lines.
Yes, behind enemy lines indeed. I'll tell you, this is incredible. ABC News doing a story about Joe Biden's comment on Barack Obama. ABC News. The mainstream media. And who does the mainstream media go to for incisive and thoughtful commentary on Barack Obama and Joe Biden?
Folks, this is the problem for the libs. Once they get off script, they expose their idiocy. They expose their prejudice.
Yeah. Believe it or not. Believe it or not. 1-866-440-8466-440-THOM, our telephone number. Will in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Will, welcome to the program.
Hey, what's up, Tom? Love listening to you, man.
Thank you.
I just had to call in, and that one of your guests that was on.
John Berlow?
With Eco Freaks.
He wrote a book called Eco Freaks, criticizing the environmental movement.
Yeah, I'm a restoration ecology major at ASU, and you can, basically debunk everything that he's talking about with a Bio 188 class. It's ridiculous. I mean, obviously he hasn't been on the CDC website at all and looked at asthma rates and cancer rates and things like that that have just exponentially grown in every major city in the U.S.
They'll take an occasional thing, like, for example, his big thing in his book, the one that he always talks about, is how when they stopped using DDT in some parts of the world because it was banned, then malaria increased. And say, see, not good for you. Well, on the other hand, you stop using DDT in those areas and the birds stop dying off. The birds are primary predators to insects. And, ultimately it'll come back into balance again. Or maybe it won't. I mean, maybe there's other alternatives. But to have something that's going to take out huge chunks of the ecosystem in order to target one particular part of the ecosystem just seems to be crazy.
Yep, he's nuts, man. I had to call him out on that one, man. The guy's crazy talk.
Okay, thanks a lot, right, Will. Tom. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. Bonnie in Burgettstown, Pennsylvania. Hey, Bonnie, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. About the same guy who called. I don't think that Consumer Reports is as liberal as the guest says. For instance, it doesn't recommend vitamins or supplements because it asserts that we can get our nutrition from our food. And it doesn't recognize that our soil isn't nearly as mineral proficient as it used to be before the chemical industry influenced farmers or before we began the factory farming, including both mass production of plants and food.
Yeah,
the
Consumer Union has, over the years, very carefully avoided most controversial areas.
And they do recommend organic food because of the low chemical exposure, but I don't think it has a position on genetically molested food, for instance, and I think it may have been against the Food Uniformity Act that disallowed labeling requirements passed by some states. But that's more of a position for consumers' right to know than against genetically modified food.
Right, which is what they're all about. I mean, they're on the side of the consumers.
But I have this, do you think I'm crazy question for you?
Mm.
You know how we were at our manufacturing zenith prior to World War II, and industry was ready to turn on a dime to manufacture war products. Well, the mechanization of farm animals is what we have now, and if anybody wants to see how ugly that inhumane practice is, they can check out PETA for that undercover video footage
sure.
of what happens to these
PETA.org,
animals.
PETA.org, yeah.
So I wonder how that industry could be converted. Do you think I'm crazy for thinking in those?
I don't think you're crazy. I don't think that the industrialization of the United States that happened in the late 19th and early 20th century was done in order to prepare for World War II.
Oh no, I don't think so either.
And we took a real hit. I mean, people didn't have rubber for tires. Women were asked not to wear nylons, stockings, so that they could make parachutes out of them, things like that during World War II. So, we really sacrificed, as it were, in order to fight that war. I agree with you that factory farming is an industry. It's one that is having terrible consequences, both on human health, on the environment, and on the communities in which it's happening. And there are a lot of communities, particularly across Pennsylvania, where the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF, CELDF.org is their website. Tom Lindsay and those guys have helped communities fight back legally, saying, sorry, you guys are not persons under the law, and communities can say, no, you can't have a 1,000 or 10,000 hog farm here.
Is that on the east end of the state?
It's happening all over the state. I think they've got over 100 communities in Pennsylvania now that have passed laws, you know, fighting back using this technology, or this legal technology, as it were. But you know, the biggest danger, frankly, of factory farming is that it could be an incubator for something like the bird flu epidemic. I mean, there's a fair amount of evidence that the flu pandemic of 1917, 1918 began in a military base in Kentucky with some birds infected some pigs and in a hog farm, and the virus mutated in the pigs into being one that was highly contagious among mammals, which includes us, because you know we're
right.
Genetically closer to pigs than we are to birds. So
yeah.
So Bonnie, I don't think you're crazy at all. It's you know where it's going to go, I don't know. But thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Pam in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Pam.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. What's up?
Well, I would have liked to have asked your guest a question. And by the way, first, I really want to thank you for having him on. He was a perfect example of the kind of linear thinking that the right has, whereas if antibiotics are causing problems and not working and things are adapting to them, create more, create stronger, just keep making more. You know,
yeah.
That's the answer.
Well, and this is meta to what Bush is saying about Iraq. You know, if a few bombs and a few soldiers didn't work, well, let's throw in some more bombs and some more soldiers.
Right, more and more. Well, but the question would have been, since he's so pro-competition in the marketplace, why is it okay that organic farmers are being driven out of business because they can no longer certify or their organic products because they're being contaminated by pollen, you know, by wind-borne pollens from
GMO products.
GMO products, right.
Yeah, genetically, as Bonnie calls them, genetically molested plants. Yeah, it's there would have been a good question, and I'm not sure what his answer would have been, but it is a very real issue and a very real problem, Pam. And in fact, there was an organic farmer up in Canada who was sued by Monsanto, as I recall, because some of his crop got pollinated by one of their crops, and they're claiming that they own the patent on the product, and therefore you can't save the seeds. And he was an organic farmer, and he was saving seeds, and he didn't even know that his plants had been contaminated. And I mean, you know, it's just getting weird. It's like you've got a handful of companies that are trying to take over the world, and
well,
one of the ways that you do it is
the rich variety of corn that is in, you know, used to be in South America is all going away.
Oh yeah, we're from hundreds of species down to a few dozen species. Yes, and the way, if you want to control the world, the way you do it is you lock down the food supply because everybody has to eat. Pam, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Huck in Northampton, Massachusetts. Hey, Huck.
Oh, okay. I didn't even know that.
You are live and on the air, Huck.
Oh, hi.
Turn off your radio.
Yes, I just wanted to say I'm great, but I'll get better.
Okay, great. Good.
And also, I wanted to ask about a constitutional crisis because I've heard you and Bernie and actually a number of others mention that. And I just wonder, well, what does that actually mean? What would happen?
Well, I'm not sure what Bernie's definition of a constitutional crisis is, and it would be good to ask him next week when he comes on, what did he mean by that phrase, because he used it 3 or 4 times today. My understanding is that typically when a member of Congress refers to a constitutional crisis, what they're talking about is a showdown between the executive branch and the legislative branch. That showdown may lead to the Supreme Court being involved on the kind of more gentle end of the spectrum, or it may lead to articles of impeachment on the more severe end of the spectrum. But, you know, you'd have to ask Bernie specifically what he meant by it. But typically it would mean, you know, that the two branches of Congress are coming into collision, and they either resolve the dispute by virtue of the Supreme Court, or the, you know, one wins or the other wins by the president either being impeached or not impeached. You know, typically that's the...
He needs to be impeached.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing with you at all. I'm not disagreeing with you at all. Huck, thanks a lot for the call. Jay in Humboldt County, California. Hey, Jay.
Good morning, Don. How are you?
I'm great. We've got about a minute before we've got to take a break. What's up?
I'll talk fast. You've talked repeatedly about what a disaster free trade is for this country, and
yes, sir.
I obviously agree with you.
I call it corporate free trade.
Hmm?
I call it corporate free trade. You know, 40% of all international trade is not done among corporations but within single corporations.
Yeah.
Where a company owns a branch in China and they own a branch in the United States and they trade with themselves, that's 40% of all so-called free trade.
Yeah, and the problem with being against free trade is the very name free trade.
I know.
Because it's so proper. So I have an idea here. You talk about reframing things,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to, as a medical person, offer this frame for free trade. Ready?
Yeah.
Okay. Free trade is like free love.
it feels great while you're doing it, but later there are consequences.
Now, that's a good one. Free
Thank
trade.
You.
Yeah, the free traders. Hey, were you guys in favor of free love at this? Probably not. Jay, thanks a lot. That's a good one. Yeah. On the other hand, that may have unintended consequences. You know, it's some people may go, not bad. You know, particularly the libertarians, the Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. Yeah, interesting. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number, 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the Darwinian world of ideas. We're at the top of the food chain. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Psychology researcher Ellen Langer of Harvard University and graduate student Aaliyah Crum had 84 women. This is from today's Science Journal by Sharon Begley in the Wall Street Journal. Had 84 women ages 18 to 55 who worked as housekeepers at 7 Boston hotels. And what they did was they told some of them that their cleaning rooms was good exercise and was good for them. And then there's others of them that they didn't tell them that. They just didn't tell them anything. And what they found was that that group of women who they told that the exercise that they were getting from, you know, changing mattresses and sheets and flipping mattresses and cleaning rooms and all that, the ones that they told that exercise was good for them, saw, in comparison to the group that wasn't told that, they're all doing the exact same work. The group that was told that, the women in the informed group lost an average of 2 pounds, saw their systolic blood pressure, that's the top number, drop 10%, lost about five-tenths of 1%, half of a percent of their body fat, and reduced their body mass index by 0.35 of a point. The other women showed no such changes. Thinking that exercise is good for you makes it even better for you. Amazing. The power of the mind. It's absolutely amazing. Number 12 in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Hey, number 12, what's up?
I have about 3 things I want to talk about. I'm going to keep you really focused today.
Yeah, but let's try and boil it down to 1 because I got a whole bunch of other calls here. Pick one.
New Mexico.
Yes, sir.
Passed the resolution turning down the Real ID Act.
Good.
The state government, including, I think it was either near unanimous or unanimous Republican support.
That's great. So the Republicans are figuring out that we, the people, would just as soon, you know, we don't mind if the cops are snooping around, the police are following us around, if we're actually, you know, there's some reason to suspect that we're guilty of a crime, but the rest of us who are, you know, God-fearing, law-abiding citizens, stay out of our lives, thank you very much.
Yes, yeah, so yeah. I think Maine also did it.
Yeah, well, good. That's great news. Thanks a lot, number 12. I appreciate it. Rudy in Rio Rancho, New Mexico. Hey, what's up, Rudy?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind?
Say, I would like to make a suggestion to Bernie. I know he's out there right now, but he could have the injured veterans that have come back in the Senate or in Congress.
You know what would happen, Rudy, if a member of Congress brought in some amputees or, you know, whatever, you know, some folks who are visibly wounded by the war, they would be accused of exploiting those troops for political purposes. And in fact, there may be some truth to that, but it would backfire on them.
Okay.
I agree with you that all of America needs to see the consequences of this war. We need to see it more visibly. We need to see it on a more regular basis. But yeah, but for a member of Congress to do that, it would be perceived as a political, and of course it would be political, and, you know, they'd take a whack for it. It wouldn't be a good thing. But, you know, it's an idea. I mean, you know, and I appreciate your thinking, and, you know, keep on thinking. and I may be wrong. You may be right, by the way, you know, so feel free to call your member of Congress and suggest it. OMD in Springfield, Oregon. Hey, OMD.
Yes, the reminder from that little phone blurb when we're waiting on our phone about the global warming and the rising of sea oceans. Consider all this voracious appetite Americans have for meat and dairy products. The animals make all that manure. We have literally lakes of manure,
right.
And that manure creates methane, which is
That's right.
Greenhouse gas.
That's right. And meat.
Plus the forest, the Amazon, the land. Yeah, it's
meat is about seven times less efficient
yeah.
as a food for you than vegetables or fruits. And if you so it takes 7 pounds of vegetables and fruits going into a cow to make 1 pound of meat on the cow. And it ain't good. It ain't good for us. It's not good for the planet. Well said. Clark in Heron, Illinois. Hey, Clark.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm fine. What's up?
Not much. I got a buddy of mine turned me on to your show, and I love it. But I really have to make the point to him and to all your listeners. I just got finished calling my congressman. Jerry Costello is a Democrat, and I think he's heading in the right direction. But I can't emphasize enough how important it is to tell your congressman, yes, we want to see investigations so they can make that the highlight, and hopefully by impeaching Bush, we can put a stop to the war in Iraq by getting somebody in power that would actually do something.
It may not even be necessary to go through the whole impeachment process to at least slow this thing down if we can simply discredit him seriously enough. Oddly enough, the Republicans thought that they were discrediting Clinton when he lied about sex kind of thing. Most of Americans... I think probably most American adults at one point or another in their lives have lied about sex, and so they just figured, hey, he's just a human being like me. It backfired on the Republicans. But most of us have not lied a country into war. Most of us have not lied in ways that have led to the death of hundreds of thousands of people. So, and most of us have not lied in ways that outed CIA officers or wiretapped other people or tortured people. So I suspect that just outing him will be enough, pointing out what's happened. Robert in Berkeley, California. Hey, Robert, we have about a minute before we've got to wrap up this
hour. Okay, I'll try to make it quick. I appreciated the earlier call in the press quite at the beginning on the question of NAFTA, but there was not an item that I think is terribly important about NAFTA that wasn't mentioned, and that is NAFTA and the huge subsidies we've given to criminal corporations like ADM is, to me, the cause of the increase in migration from Mexico.
Because we're wiping out the small family farmers in Mexico, and the resulting poverty is driving people into the United States.
We were talking about millions of people, right?
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Robert, I agree with you. And that's a very, very serious problem. Although, they wouldn't come here if somebody wouldn't hire them. And so, I get back to, let's not blame the people. We don't have an illegal immigrant problem in the United States. We have an illegal employer problem in the United States. And that's the level at which we need to deal with it. It's all about the corporations. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 6 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Last year, as we were leading up to the election cycle, as we were leading up to November, we had a regular feature on this program, sometimes a couple of times a week, at least once a week. Very often 2, 3, sometimes even 4 times a week, we would have on our Taking My Country Back music, and we would have on a candidate who was running for Congress. Here are the way that we used to intro these things.
And I'm taking my country back. Son, you ain't been doing her right. Oh, I've been watching you and I don't like. You've been treating my stars and stripes. You took our jobs and sent them overseas. Now we owe billions to the red Chinese. You blew the budget and you bossed Iraq. So
So I'm taking my country back.
So we did our country, I'm taking my country back segment over and over and over. The number of candidates, and quite a few of them won. So I thought we'd follow up with one of them here. Congressman Jason Altmaier's on the line with us. He represents the 4th Congressional District of Pennsylvania. He was one of our Taking Back America segments. Congressman, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Tom, and I'll tell you, we got as good a response from the appearance I did on your show as just about anything we did in the campaign. You have quite a following, and it made a big difference for me, so I really appreciate you allowing me the opportunity to be on.
That's great to know. Thank you very much. I wanted to talk with you about, first of all, one of the reasons I'm really pleased to have you back on is you're one of the more progressive members of the House of Representatives, and wanted to get into some of the issues that you're seeing. But also there's a process thing that's happening. It seems that the House of Representatives is changing in some significant ways right now. Can you talk about that?
Well, that's right. Are you talking about the ethics rules or the?
Well, no, it's not even that. Just the, you know, I understand. Maybe I'm wrong on this. Correct me if I'm wrong. But my understanding is that the leadership, the Democratic leader, you know, Nancy Pelosi and whatnot, it's that the House is being run a little less top down. That they're encouraging feedback from the freshman members like yourself. They're listening. That there's a lot more progressives. That more progressive ideas are being accepted. That the DLC is kind of on the run.
Well,
go at it.
A lot of the members that are new freshmen came from districts that are marginal seats. They could go either way. Some of them, I think there's 6 or 8 that have Republican advantages in their seats. And the speaker, in every meeting that I've been in with her, and she meets with the freshman class weekly, she says, look, you represent your district. You don't represent the party first. You represent your constituents first. They sent you here to do what needs to be done for your district. So your first obligation is to go back home, listen to what they have to say, and vote the way within your conscience that they want you to vote. And I don't think that has been the way it has been in the past. There's not going to be any rubber stamping of the agenda with this Congress. So she's given the freshmen the freedom without the authoritarian rule to do what they need to do to come back, because if we don't bring these freshmen back next year, we lose the majority and we're right back where we started from.
Yeah, and frankly, I mean, that's the notion on which this whole country was founded, but that's not the way that, certainly it's not the way the Republicans ran Congress, and even, I would argue, some Democratic speakers of the House didn't run Congress that way.
No, it's a new thing, and I will say that Speaker Pelosi, I think, has done more to change the way Congress has operated than probably many of her predecessors had done, because this is a situation for 12 years we had top-down rule, and you had to have a majority of the majority for anything to be brought to the floor. The Republicans had to have had in their own ranks the majority, and we have passed in the first 100 hours, as I'm sure you have talked about, several pieces of legislation that are things that the American people want us to do, and they've passed with substantial bipartisan support. With what we did in the first 100 hours, we averaged 62 Republican votes, and even beyond that, with the continuing resolution last week, we got 57 Republican votes. So in the end, they will vote our way, although with procedural votes and things like that, they'll argue before it happens, but they know that we're doing what the American people want us to do, and they don't want to be on the wrong side.
Yeah, it's amazing to me here in Oregon watching Senator Gordon Smith, who for 4 years has been an absolute hard right-winger with Bush, you know, over 90% of the time, and all of a sudden he's coming out against the war. He's got an election coming up in 2 years, you know, and he's running scared. I think a lot of Republicans are, and it's great, frankly, that they are joining you guys and you are getting things done. We're talking with Congressman Jason Altmaier in the 4th Congressional District of Pennsylvania. One of the things that you're working on, one of the things you're pushing hard, is to allow younger people to buy into the Medicare system. Tell me about this.
Absolutely. I feel that we all know the problems with the health care system. I won't belabor the point. We have the 47 million uninsured. We're spending $2 trillion a year, more than any other country in the world, far more, and we finished so far as 37th when compared to other countries in outcomes of our health care. So we're not getting our money's worth. And I think one of the ways we could make healthcare more affordable and accessible is by allowing people under the age of 65 to buy into Medicare on a voluntary basis. And what this does is helps on both sides of the equation. It allows younger people one more option, employers one more option for healthcare, but just as important, it infuses a younger and healthier population into the Medicare system, people who are paying customers, but they're not going to use the services as much, which will shore up the Medicare trust fund for the long term.
Right, yeah, and ultimately, I mean, wouldn't the ideal be to simply say, let's just make Medicare cover everybody?
Well, there's a lot of members of the Democratic Caucus who want to move in that direction. We had President Clinton last night address the Democratic Caucus, and one of the things he talked about was expanding Medicare. He doesn't want to do it all at once either, but he does think that that's the direction to go. And I do think there's a consensus building within the Democratic Caucus that that's a direction that we need to move.
I think Americans are way out ahead of Congress on this. I think the average American, if you said, you know, would you be willing to pay a higher FICA tax and know that you have absolute health insurance? And plus, like in Canada, you know, the typical wage earner pays about $40 a month into the system to have access to it. So, that, you know, there is a small fee to participate in the program. And people below the poverty level don't have to pay it. And people who are very wealthy, it's, you know, maybe $100 a month.
Well, and something to look at that's happened just over the last 5 years, we've added 4% more of the American people to the rolls of the uninsured, but the insurance companies have added 34% more in overhead costs. So why is it that we need 34% more money to pay for 4% less people in the system? It just
right.
doesn't make sense.
Well, so they can pay their CEOs hundreds of millions of dollars a year.
Right.
You got Bill McGuire taking his $1.78 billion paycheck, you know.
And it's estimated that there's 2 million people in the system, some on the insurance side, some on the provider side, whose only job it is to lob back and forth arguments about who's going to pay and who's not going to pay, and are we going to deny coverage? Are we going to cover this service?
Right.
And it just doesn't make any sense.
This is nuts. It's time for the guys with the green eye shades, these boring public servants who have boring civil service jobs and boring paychecks and decent pensions so that they're going to be there for a career to take over like they do with Social Security. I mean, Social Security's never failed to write a check.
And what President Bush recommended in his State of the Union address to deal with health care is not to increase access to your doctor or that you need to go see your physician. He recommends you go see your accountant. If you want to access health care, you need to look at what the tax law is and figure out whether you qualify for some tax deduction that's going to take place 18 months from now.
Yeah, so the low-income people who don't pay any income taxes can use that tax deduction that they can't use because they don't pay the taxes to pay for the health insurance account that they can't afford because they don't have enough income to pay for it.
Right. There's 58 million Americans who don't make enough money to pay income taxes, and these are the people we're trying to reach. So President Bush's solution not only doesn't reach them, it just provides another tax shelter for the young and the healthy, and in many cases, the wealthy.
Yeah, it's nuts. What are you, Congressman Jason Altmaier, Pennsylvania, 4th District of Pennsylvania, what are you guys going to do about Iraq? What are you going to do about George Bush and what I would submit to you are the crimes that this man has committed against the United States?
Well, this is obviously the biggest issue facing the country today. We've discussed it at length. We are in our Democratic retreat this weekend, and we're hearing from generals who've been on the ground and others, and there is a consensus. It doesn't take any thought to see that we made a mistake going there and that we have bungled this every step of the way, but the fact is we are presented with the scenario that we're there today, and what are we going to do about it? So we're just trying to do this in a way that's not going to harm in any way the brave men and women who are in harm's way right now, and we're not, I don't think, going to move down the road of withdrawing the funding that's going to keep them safe and give them the equipment and the military manpower they need to continue the mission that they are there right now. The discussion is on the escalation. Are we going to fund that, and are we going to move forward with that? And that's where it gets dicey.
Well, put my vote in for pull the money and get them out. Pay for their trip home, period. You represent your district, and folks in your district can contact you toll-free, 866-220-0044. Congressman Jason Altmaier, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. And welcome back to the place where being progressive never felt so good. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, 21 minutes past the hour. On the line with us, Swami Beyond Ananda from wakeuplaughing.com, the website. Swami, welcome.
Well, how are you?
I am fine. I'm fine, but I'll get better. How about you?
Oh, I'm doing great. You know, I'm just about to launch my annual State of the Universe address.
Now, why deliver the State of the Universe address on Groundhog Day?
Well, you know, the body politic needs to emergency our shadow, otherwise 2 more years of darkness. And the best way to see the shadow is to shine the light of laughter onto the undarkened corridors of power. And it's quite appropriate to laugh because, as you know, there's definitely something funny going on.
That's the so what is the State of the Universe?
Well, the universe is doing fabulous, thank you. It's purring with perfection, ever-changing, same as always. And, you know, light is still cruising along at 186,000 miles per second. The expanding universe shows no signs of contracting. And, you know, at this rate, it won't be long before they'll have to let the photon belt out a couple of notches again. But, of course, down here on Earth, it's a little bit different. It's a little more problematical. And, you know, the concerned scientists have just moved the doomsday clock to 5 minutes to midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And even some of the unconcerned scientists are starting to get a little concerned. Now, with all due respect to Wilson Pickett, if this midnight hour ever comes, it won't be the love that comes tumbling down, you know?
Yeah. Well, is there any good news?
Well, listen, here's the good news. An evolutionary uprising is underway in America, and not a moment too soon.
An uprising?
An uprising, yes. Americans are waking up and wising up.
Okay.
You know, confidence in this administration has hit Iraq bottom.
Yes.
And people are realizing that the real abomination is tobomination.
Mm.
And that's why in November the unarmed forces won a great victory. And we can be sure that the evolution has begun. There's proof, because the day after the election, the first big shot was fired.
Yeah, but it doesn't seem to have much of an impact on Bush.
Well, you know, the president has stepped up his counterintelligence program. Everything he does seems to go counter to intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it looks like now even the Republicans are ready to put the decider through the decider mill. You know, I think maybe they're afraid that with 2 more years of this, the party of Lincoln and Ford will go the way of the Edsel.
I think it is, yeah.
But, and you know, there's another sign of uprising, very important. Thanks to Al Gore, the media finally warmed up to climate change, and global warming became a hot issue. As soon as the movie Inconvenient Truth came out, the Bush administration issued their rebuttal, called appropriately enough, Convenient Lies.
Yeah, very convenient. Clearly the Earth is one sick puppy right now.
Well, and in need of a miracle cure for sure. So if we want spontaneous remission, then we humans have to have a spontaneous remissioning. We need to change our mission from it's every man for himself to we're all in this together.
A radical change.
Well, yes, it's a radical change. You know, they say necessity is the mother of invention. And if you look at necessity right now, it's quite a mother. So, yeah, because you know, for millennia, we humans have persistently pursued manifest destiny and survival of the fittest. But when you think about it, it doesn't matter how fit the individual is. If the species doesn't fit, well, listen, if you thought man without a country was a sad story, where do you see man without a planet? Because, you know, maybe global warming is just the Earth running a fever, trying to get rid of a bad case of us.
Ouch.
Now, don't get me wrong. There have been some really great humans. Gandhi, you know, Mother Teresa, Elvis.
Elvis?
Yeah, he was a great spiritual teacher. I still subscribe to Elvis's threefold path. Love me tender, please surrender, return to center. But no, really, I mean, there have been lots and lots of wonderful individuals, but collectively, I'm telling you, if any one of us were allowed to do what we allow all of us to do, we'd be put away forever. Yeah. So, you know, while we weren't looking, I think somebody must have changed the Ten Commandments. You know, now it's, thou shalt not kill unless done in extremely large groups.
Yeah, you'd think our religions would help out here, you know.
Well, you know, I'm a hopeless hopium addict, so I believe you can indeed teach an old dogma new tricks. But maybe the Ten Commandments are too many. Maybe we need to start out smaller, like with one suggestion.
Yeah, I like that. The one suggestion. What one suggestion would you suggest?
Well, I suggest that since we are all one with the same one, we treat each other accordingly, and let go of the popular credo, do unto others before they can do unto you. And, you know, I think it's time for all the children of God to finally grow up and become adults of God for a change.
Does that make you a creationist or an evolutionist?
Well, I'm both. I believe humans were created to evolve. Otherwise, Jesus would have said, now don't do a thing till I get back. Now, listen, I think we are here to earn God's love, not to spend. We're not here to earn God's love. We are here to spend it. Mm-hmm. I call this supply-side spirituality. Be more supplying and less demanding.
I think it's an absolutely marvelous, marvelous concept. Swami Beyondananda, thanks so much for being with us. Your 2007 State of the Universe address, it's over at your website, wakeuplaughing.com. Thanks so much.
And thank you, and may the farts be with you.
And with you, too. Swami Beyondananda, wakeuplaughing.com. 27 minutes past the hour. We're going to do our book, Cracking the Code, when we come back from the break.
Yes, if you wanna move, you got to know. Oh, baby, if you wanna, baby, if you wanna.
And welcome back. Talk radio for the rest of us. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. For the last couple of months, we've been working on this chapter by chapter here, doing something, to the best of my knowledge, never done before, writing a book on the radio. Our book, which will either be out this fall or next spring, we'll see, you know, how we pull this thing together, but it's moving along fairly well. It's going to be titled Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. And this week's chapter, Speaking Directly to the Unconscious Mind. Now, there's two really primary dimensions to this, and they both come out of the fact that the unconscious mind, unlike the conscious mind, doesn't filter information. Our conscious mind is actually a fairly competent filter of information. If I say, you know, don't do something, you know, you can process the not doing it. You know, don't run out into the street. The conscious mind says, okay, don't run out in the street. The teacher says to the kid, don't speak out during, you know, in class. The kid doesn't speak out during class. The unconscious mind, however, is not able to process negatives. And it's also not able to process the separation of the word you from context. Now, let me explain what this means. George Lakoff, in his book, Don't Think of an Elephant, put it right in the title. In order for you to know what to not think of, you have to first think of it. Now, that's the conscious mind operating at that level. But there's also the unconscious mind not being able to process the no. So, you know, again, it brings up the idea. So if, you know, Joe Biden, for example, saying that he's not a racist, what does that do? It brings up the picture in the mind of Joe Biden as a racist, which, you know, nobody thinks he is. I don't think he is, and you know, people around him don't think he is, but that's the meme that his political opponents want out there. And, you know, he put his foot in his mouth the other day in a small way, and it's been turned into a big deal. And that's the subtext to it. So the very careful line that he has to walk is how to not identify what it is he's trying to not own. And the way to do it is to, if instead of him saying that he's not a racist, he should be stating things in an affirmative sense, in a positive sense, so that there's congruence between the conscious knowledge of what's being said and the unconscious knowledge of it. Instead, he should be saying, I'm in favor of viewing all people the same, regardless of their skin color. I'm in favor of civil rights. I've been working with the civil rights movement for years, for decades. I'm very clear, and which he did, by the way, yesterday on Chris Matthews' show, although Matthews kept bringing it around and bringing it around and bringing it around. But that's the only way to do it. Because the unconscious mind can't process the word no. This is one of the reasons why the Frank Luntz had suggested that instead of referring to climate change, Republicans should refer to global warming, which evokes a very specific picture. Warming means something to us, and global. You know, you think of the planet ever since, 1964, I think, when that picture from outer space of the Earth as a marble, that's probably the most published picture that's ever existed. Ever since that picture came out, there's been a change, actually, in the way that we consciously and unconsciously think of the Earth. In many ways, it kicked off the environmental movement. Because we realized, hey, we're all in this thing together. There we are in this little marble, so this globe. And so when you talk about global warming, it produces a very specific picture. So instead, he said that Republicans should use the phrase climate change, because that's more vague. Climate is an abstraction. What does climate mean? Well, I don't like the climate of this conference. I mean, it can mean something that's political. It can mean something that's weather-like. And change is not necessarily a negative. It's, again, ambiguous. Now, interestingly, the scientific community has also embraced climate change to some extent. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental CC is climate change. It is being embraced by the scientific community because, in fact, there are parts of the globe that are getting warmer. There are other parts that might be getting colder. But the point is that the unconscious mind doesn't process knows. And in fact, very often, the unconscious mind will hear no in the English language, N-O, as K-N-O-W, whereas the conscious mind will sometimes hear K-N-O-W as N-O. So, you know, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you didn't know, and you don't know that you don't know what you don't know, and therefore you need to know what you don't know, because you don't know that you don't know it, and the fact that you don't know that you don't know it causes you not to know that you don't know it, and that then leaves you vulnerable to the consequences of it, right, for example. That's the other thing. You start stacking negatives, and you can induce confusion, and that's a way that you can actually induce a trance, which is something that we'll talk about next week. So anyhow, number one, the use of the word no. The second is the use of the word you, Y-O-U. The unconscious mind always hears the word you as directed at the individual. The conscious mind is able to put the word you in context. Now, this is something that is used in a variety of ways. And politicians use it a lot, but it's also, there's a whole technology, a whole industry around sales and seduction that uses this as their primary tool, where you tell somebody a story about somebody else and you insert the word you into it. And so you're talking to somebody and say I was talking to, you know, a woman, and then I were to say, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was talking to his girlfriend, and this is somebody that you don't know, right? And I was talking to a friend of mine, and he was talking to his girlfriend, and he said to her, you know, you're really beautiful. I really, really love you, and I really think that we can have a great time together and have a really wonderful relationship. And he said she really liked hearing that. And, I just thought it was really nice that he was able to say that to her. Now, the other person at the conscious level, the thing to respond to is, was it nice that your friend was able to say that to his girlfriend? But at the unconscious level, what the person receiving what I just said will hear is, I really love you. Because there's a you in there, or you're really beautiful, or whatever, you know, feeling weak and these kinds of things. In sales, the same thing. You know, some people will come in here and tell me that when they drive this car, they just say to me, you have the best car made. You know, I just love this car. And they'll, or, you know, I'll, yeah, they, you can imagine how you can carry this thing out. There's a variety of ways to do this. So politicians need to be using the word you as much as possible, even if it's in a secondary sense. And when you convey messages to politicians, you might want to consider that. So be very careful about using the word you. I remember just yesterday, Louise, my wife, and I were at lunch, and she was telling me the story of a conversation she had with somebody, and the person was saying something to her and using the word you that was a rather negative context, you know, complaining about something or somebody else. And Louise quoted that person, and I suddenly found myself feeling, and I just had to interrupt her. I said, "You mean she said that?" And Louise was like, "Yes, she said that about somebody else." This is person A talking about person B telling that person to Louise, and now Louise telling it to me. So here we have a story that's now twice removed, but it still has the word you in it, and I'm still feeling it. Now, the useful time that you can use the word you is for indirect confrontation. If you're having a political argument with somebody or a political discussion with somebody, and you want to bring them into it, you want to have them imagine themselves in that situation, but you don't want to do it in a really confrontational way. You could say something like, you know, the other day I was talking to a friend, and he went down to the homeless shelter, and he said, you can't imagine how difficult the lives of these people are. You would have to be, you know, some disconnected from life to understand how difficult it is. I mean, you'd have to be, you know, just almost criminally disconnected from humanity to not care about these people. And I said to him, you know, yeah, I agree. And now it's not a statement to the person that you're saying it to. It's not a slap, but at a certain level, they'll take it as that. And, you know, perhaps they'll respond in a confrontational way. Perhaps it'll cause them to think. So start noticing, first of all, the use of negatives, particularly in advertising and political dialogue, and start noticing the use of the word you, how you use it and how other people use it. 45 minutes past the hour.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
A special thanks to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Andrew Dunn, Alex Goldmark, Lauren Kirchner at Air America Radio, to Ben and Shelby at the White Rose Society and RadioPower.org, Sue Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, Scott Elberg, Amy Winslow, Tamara, all the folks at Air America who help make this thing work, our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Nothing ambiguous about that, right? You're what helps make it happen and make it work, and it is much appreciated, your calls. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. And just before we move on, I just have to share with you this little Twilight Zone alert. It's very, very strange, the things that are happening here. Yes. This. Whoa, what happened? There we go. Yes, UFO sightings in France are set to be revealed, exciting paranormal enthusiasts in the UK. The archive of over 1,600 incidents will be released by France's National Space Studies Center and is led for a call for the UK to do the same thing. The Minister of Defense of France said that they were, quote, open-minded about the existence of extraterrestrial life forms. This is from the British newspaper The Sun. Interesting. Carol in Chandler, Arizona, listening on KPHX. Hey, Carol, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you. I wanted to talk to you about the word you and two distinct areas where I found using that word was detrimental to what I wanted to accomplish. Mm-hmm. The first one is talking to teenagers.
Yes.
Yes, and the second
Well, in fact, if I can just give you an example, Andrew and I were just talking, Andrew, our board operator, Andrew Dunn in New York, and he was talking about how with his band, he's in a rock band. Andrew, is it a rock band? Or is it a... Yeah, okay. I don't want to misrepresent. And how he was noticing... I hope it's okay that I'm telling this story. He was noticing... Oh, good. Thank you. He was noticing that when somebody would say, you played that wrong, or you should play that a different way, that people would be much more quick to take offense than when somebody would put it in the third person, take the word you out of the sentence altogether and say, you know, or even personalize it. Say, I think that that bit should be played this way, or that, you know, might sound differently this way without the use of the word you at all.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
the second scenario was when I was a union steward dealing with management either on grievances or in a labor management meeting, and if you use the word you, the defensive walls immediately go up.
Yes.
Whereas if you third person, like management does this or I have found that this action causes this,
mm-hmm.
They're much more receptive to working with
you. Now, here would be a way that you could use the word you as a negotiating tool, as a way of gaining some psychological power, as it were. I really hesitate to make this sound like it's just heavy manipulation, but that is ultimately the goal of all communication, is to accomplish something in a management situation like this, to make it personal. So where you, if you were talking to the management and you were representing labor and you didn't want to confront them with the word you could say to them something like, many of our members say to us that what they would like to say to management is, you guys are taking advantage of us and you guys are hurting our families by not giving us good health care. And I say to our members when they say that to me that I'll share that grievance with management, and so I'm here to, you know, share with you their concern. And now they've received that message at the unconscious level emotionally, but they have to respond at the conscious level intellectually.
Right, right. It's very difficult in labor management dealing with both parties and even trying to get both parties to communicate with each other. And I have taught labor management communication skills mm-hmm. to adults, and even that is difficult to try to get them to understand without saying, well, if you talk this way and you listen this way, it would work out much better.
Right, right. And yet that this is what we all have to do. We all have to learn how to be better communicators. I mean, it's just particularly if we have, you know, a real goal here, which is to save the world.
Exactly.
Carol, okay. thanks so much for your call.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you. You too. To everybody, you know, TGIF, Shabbat Shalom, whatever's appropriate. I hope you all have a great weekend. Prominent global warming deniers, by the way, just to wrap this thing up, such as Rush Limbaugh and Senator James Inhofe, are already downplaying the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. This new report, which has come out, saying that 90% certainty global warming is being affected in a very significant way by human activity, and it's not going to be good. And how are they responding? Well, the American Enterprise Institute, who, you know, has been on this program before, the American Enterprise Institute is offering scientists $10,000 if they will, well, here's the report. Scientists and economists have been offered $10,000 each by a lobby group funded by one of the world's largest oil companies to undermine a major climate change report due to be published today. And ExxonMobil has helped fund the American Enterprise Institute, and now they're out saying, you want to take a shot at this thing? We'll give you some bucks. Coming up on Monday's program, the top news of the day, plus 761 illegal aliens were arrested in L.A. and quickly deported. Was that a victory for border security? Find out when I debate Al Garza on this issue. Mark Lloyd is here on why the FCC will get media ownership wrong again. and what they should do to get it right. That and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people. And remember, my friends, democracy and activism begin with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.